In 2002, Dwight, Luke, and I moved to Northern Virginia, just outside D.C. And before that, Dwight and I had lived in the Virginia countryside. We were so excited to be near D.C. again. I had lived there after college and it had a number of wonderful friends there, and my grandparents lived there. But by the time we moved back, my friends had moved on, and my grandparents had died. And so we were really starting from scratch in terms of building a community and a life there. And so even though that we had this, what was a little baby at the time, we each worked in a different Episcopal church that had about 1,200 members, and life was hopping. These were just churches where there was always something going on, and we weren't quite sleeping then. We hungered for community. We just hungered for community. And so we invited another couple with a small child we had met over for lunch. And if you have not yet lived in the D.C. area, one thing you would need to know is in D.C. you meet some of the most interesting people you've ever met in your life. But their job is their life. They work all the time. I see some smiling out there. They work all the time. Your job is just the whole source of your identity. The only time you get a Sabbath is when it snows. That's the good news. When there's one flake of snow, everybody just says, I can't get into work. That's the only time anybody takes a break in D.C. And it's just people don't make time for family or friends or fun. So we booked this couple months in advance. We found a date like 4 months in advance where we could all have lunch. And I love to have people over, but I'm afraid my gift set is not that of Karen Fifeley and Joan Hirschbell and Robin Johnson and others here. It really stresses me out to make a meal for a group larger than my family. I wish it weren't so, but it's just not my gift set. And so I just wanted to have this couple over so badly. So Dwight and I got going, and we made some kind of main dish. I remember we put a lot of time into it, and a fruit soup and a dessert. And about 2 hours before the meal, the husband called, and he said the wife had an awful lot of work to do, and so they weren't going to be coming to lunch. And we were so sad. We were sad for ourselves. We were sad for this couple. And we were sad for this woman who was just, I know she was also under a lot of pressure, but chose to miss the feast. I wonder if you've ever had a similar experience. The parable that you just heard today from Matthew's gospel, which is the third parable in a row in this section of Matthew's gospel, is really strange. We know that parables are strange, and also these wonderful treasures that you unpack over the course of your lifetime. They're not to be fully understood. They usually have a lot of layers, but to me, this particular parable is disturbing, like last week's parable, because it contains violence. In it, a king sends his servants to remind a group that has been specially selected, specially chosen, to attend the wedding banquet for his son. Can you imagine getting that invitation? This is the king. This is going to be an amazing banquet. They are slaughtering every animal you could imagine. The wines are going to be fabulous. Food is going to be flowing. There's no refrigeration, so they're just going to go for it. All the food has to be eaten. But for whatever reasons, this first group that was invited hasn't come. So the king sends his servants, "Where are you? Did you not understand the invitation? We're here. The food is here. It's going to go bad. The party is here. Come join us. Come join me and my son." But they ignore this second invitation or this follow-up to the invitation. The king is puzzled, and he sends out another group of servants to these same folks. I don't know, maybe that first group of servants, they weren't good communicators. I don't know what's going on, but come to my son's wedding banquet. I want to celebrate with you. This is the party of the year. It is ready and waiting. But this time, the people can't really be bothered. One goes to his farm, another to his business. And the most perplexing part to me, some people kill these servants who have gone out to remind them about this wonderful party. So the king has just had it. He goes out and demolishes the city and has revenge upon the people who have killed his servants. And he tells another group of servants, I want you to go out into the streets and I want you to invite everybody to this party, all the people who haven't received an invitation previously, everyone, the good and the bad, I want the banquet hall full, and I want you to invite everybody to come to this party. Perhaps most puzzling, when all these folks are then at this wedding feast, one man at the party is not properly dressed, and his failure to wear a proper wedding robe gets the king so mad that he binds this person and throws him out into the outer darkness where there is weeping and gnashing of teeth. And I imagine there is more than one of us who wondered if we were that man. Yikes. This is not the God I know. The God revealed most fully in Jesus of Nazareth, the God of healing and life, the God who is very comfortable speaking the truth and what might sound like a hard word, and yet the violence is very troubling and puzzling. Now, I'm not one to gloss over the disturbing parts of this or any other passage. But when I look at the history of the period in which this parable was written and what was going on in Matthew's community, it helps me to understand the parable a little better, although not to justify the violence. Jesus' parable in Matthew's gospel is told to a largely Jewish audience, Jews who have found Jesus to be the long-awaited Messiah. And they are experiencing serious conflicts and a lot of trouble with the synagogue down the street, and whose members do not believe Jesus is the Messiah. So this is not a Christian-Jewish conflict. This is an intramural Jewish conflict between two Jewish communities. Now, we can thus understand at some level the frustration of the Jewish community that has found Jesus to be the Messiah. They have found their prayers to be answered, their hopes to be answered, their lives changed by the life and the ministry and the teachings of this man. And they can't understand why their fellow Jews have rejected him. The destruction of the city mentioned in this parable is thought to evoke the destruction of the Jerusalem temple by the Romans in 70 AD. The Jews at the time believed God allowed the temple to be destroyed because of their faithlessness. Now, the Isaiah reading, which you heard before the gospel, takes place in the post-exilic period, after the Jews in Jerusalem have experienced destruction and devastation at the hands of one group after another. The Moabites, the Assyrians, the Babylonians, all have devastated the Jews, especially in the south, and their life and their land and their livelihoods taken away their intellectuals, primarily their leaders, into exile. And so it's quite striking to me that at this time in the Hebrew Scriptures, this time of devastation and hurting and in some ways licking wounds and introspection, life with God is pictured as a heavenly banquet, including people from all nations, including the Moabites, the Babylonians, and the Assyrians. This is amazing. This is something to me that is from God. In the midst of a time where it would just be, the human impulse would be to seek revenge, life with God is pictured as a heavenly banquet table, including people from all nations. God's kingdom or reign was understood as a place of feasting and joy and healing. God's table is overflowing with delicious food and drink. And the grief and suffering that we experience in this life is healed by God. Every tear is wiped away. And if this reading sounds familiar, we hear it most often at funerals. Matthew picks up on this notion of the heavenly banquet table, and he takes it one step further. God is determined to have a full banquet hall. The God who puts out a wonderful spread for his people, the God who puts together the most amazing party you've ever been to, won't be satisfied until the banquet hall is filled. Further, the hall is not filled with the people you would expect, but with the people who surprise you. Now, what about the person who shows up with the wrong clothes? In Jesus' day, it was typical for the king to provide proper robes for all of his guests. Now, while some have suggested that the robe here is some kind of metaphor for being clothed in Christ, as we are at baptism, that doesn't explain why the bad and the good are included in the party crowd, and only one person is thrown out. And if you understand that, please let me know. Please email me. I think the major point Jesus is trying to make here in this parable, which is not supposed to be taken as literally true, but having lessons in it, insights in it, and things in it that disturb us and shock us. But I think the major point Jesus is trying to make is even though life with God is the party we dream of, the company we dream of, the relationships we dream of, even though God is offering us a way of life that will give us joy and ultimate fulfillment, even though Jesus willingly made himself vulnerable and suffered so that we might live, and even though God does everything impossible to invite us to the party, we are so darn busy and preoccupied with our own cares and concerns that we miss God's feast that is going on right in our midst. We walk right by the opportunities God is constantly giving us to connect with others, experience joy in our relationships and in our work, and have the meaning and abundant life we desire. We constantly walk by the gifts others are offering us. We don't follow Jesus' way, even though it's the way to life. We are so busy and inward focused, what Lisa last Sunday night called curved inward, that we miss God's invitation to participate in the life and quality of relationships that we hunger for. Not long ago, a 9-year-old boy named Cain built an arcade in the front part of his dad's auto parts store in East Los Angeles. started out, Kane was at home for the summer, and his dad had a lot of boxes in the back because this family business now is mostly online. So the dad ships out auto parts through eBay. But Kane was sitting there and wondering what to do, and he had picked up a little basketball hoop at a neighborhood pizza place. And so he saw some of the boxes, and he loved arcades. And he made an arcade game. He attached this basketball hoop to this cardboard box and made quite an elaborate game out of it. Well, he really enjoyed that, and he got pretty inspired and fired up. And so he started to make copies of all the arcade games that he knew and loved until they took over the whole front of his dad's auto parts store. And he put up a sign that said Kane's Arcade, and he even had a t-shirt made. But he stopped wearing it to school because the kids didn't believe that he had an arcade. But he would sit in his arcade day after day during the summer. Unfortunately, a lot of people didn't come by because most of the business for this auto parts store was online. But he would invite the few customers that walked in to play in the arcade. But they just walked away, said, no thanks. Well, one day, there was a documentary filmmaker named Nirvan, and a handle had fallen off his 96 Corolla, so he went out to this auto parts store, which is located right next to a junkyard in East LA, and he bought the handle and was leaving, and Kane invited him to play in the arcade, and he stopped. And he said, how much does it cost to play in this arcade? And Kane said, well, for $1, you get 4 turns. But for $2, you could get a fun pass, and you get up to 500 turns in a month. And Nirvan said, well, I'm getting the fun pass. And so he bought the fun pass, and he stayed for a while and played arcade games. And he discovered quickly, this guy was a genius. When you won a game, Kane would kind of crawl back into the cardboard box and feed tickets out a little slot so you could collect your tickets for prizes. Well, Nirvan came back later, asked the dad if he could make a film about Kane and his arcade. And when he was there, he learned that he had been Kane's only customer. So he went on a site called Hidden LA with the dad's approval, and invited Los Angeles to come to Kane's Arcade. Have any of you seen this? It went viral. It went viral. It went to the front page of Reddit. And people were emailing in from all over the country and world saying, oh darn, I live in New York. I'd really like to come to Kane's Arcade. But they picked a time and a date and invited a flash mob to come play at the arcade, and they kept this from Kane. His dad took him to the local pizza place, and when they came back, he arrived and saw about 100 people who had come early to paint signs, and they were chanting, we want to play, we want to play. And they stayed, this group of about 100 people stayed and played in this arcade all afternoon. They had a marvelous time together. After that, I guess people from around the world, from London and Spain, came to East LA to visit Kane's Arcade. In our parable, one group turned down an amazing invitation to join the king's party and feast with others. In another story, about 100 people from LA showed up to celebrate with a 9-year-old boy and play together in his arcade. Which group experienced the abundant life God promises us? What is preventing you from participating in the life God is inviting you into? Amen.